This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on today's Trumpet Hour. We are ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, we've just finished our February 2018 Trumpet print edition this week, and our cover story is Jerusalem, the after effects of the Trump administration's December 6th announcement recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital continue to unfold. This week, we got a better idea of just how divisive that decision was. We at the Trumpet watched Jerusalem closely. This is where the spark for the final sequence of end time events will be set off. And the headlines that this city is making right now are definitely moving us closer to the fulfillment of those biblical prophecies that we're watching for, specifically events that unfolded this week in the United Nations. We're going to turn for this story to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
So there were a couple of resolutions that that came before the United Nations Security Council, and then a similar resolution that came before the General Assembly on Thursday. It was voted on by the General Assembly, basically denouncing what Mr. Trump did, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And it seems that a lot of states, nations were very upset by this. They took it to the UN. Part of the text of this resolution said this, that the UN General Assembly expresses deep regret at the recent decisions concerning the status of Jerusalem. It affirmed that any decisions and actions which purport to have altered the character, status, or demographic composition of the holy city of Jerusalem have no legal effect, are null and void, and must be rescinded in compliance with the relevant resolutions of the Security Council. And so basically it's saying, what you've did, you must rescind that, United States of America. How dare you claim that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel? And in response to this, when this resolution passed, 129 people, nations voted for it. I think there were 9 nations that voted against it and a number of abstentions. And Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the United Nations from the United States, got up and gave a blazing speech basically saying that this vote from the UN has everything about the UN trying to step on United States sovereignty. We can decide where we want to put an embassy or what we believe is a capital. That's none of your business. But then also she made some threats saying that they are taking names. They're taking names of the nations that did not vote with them, did not abstain. And then they even threatened to withhold funding to these nations in the future that didn't vote with the United States.
It really is an extraordinary demonstration of just how isolated the United States is. What strikes me is when you look at what happened in the Security Council earlier on in the week, that you had 14 nations, all 14 other nations besides the United States saying, well, the United States needs to rescind this. And the U.S. says, basically, we're not going to listen to any of you. We're going to do what we want to do. And the threats that you mentioned, and before the General Assembly vote, they said, we're going to keep track and we're going to hold you to account if you vote against the United States. 128 nations, including, you know, all of the big nations that you would expect. I mean, there were several who abstained. And the United States, you know, publicly thanked them for doing this. But the United Kingdom, you know, France, Germany, all of these countries that it seems like they are taking pleasure, a certain amount of glee in defying the United States on this. The way that the Trump administration and Nikki Haley presented this, it really did offer these nations a choice. And put it in very stark terms, and these nations said, "No, we're not interested in following you on this."
Yeah, it became a pro: are you with us or against us? Not Israel, whether Jerusalem's there, but are you with us or against us with the United States? And as you said, all of Western Europe voted with this resolution, which was, again, defying the United States, there were a number of smaller nations that actually abstained or voted against it. This vote, actually, the United States or Israel did better in this vote, even though it still looks horrible, than they have done in previous votes. And I think some of those smaller nations were worried that the United States would pull the funding, the aid that they give them, because that would really affect those nations more than it might Germany, France, and so on. But again, the big powers, the major powers, all of them voted against the United States on this.
Well, let's talk about just developments within this point that we've been making about just how much this sidelines the United States as the mediator of choice for the peace process. More movement on that front this week as well.
Yeah, we had on Thursday, Mahmoud Abbas was in France talking to the French president. Of course, right now, the other leaders in Europe seem to be kind of busy with other things. Brexit in the United Kingdom, Germany's got its own issues. So France is like, okay, we'll be the vocal, the voice for Europe on this. And in a joint press conference with Emmanuel Macron, this is what he said, Mahmoud Abbas. He said, I confirmed to President Macron, so this was just after the press conference, that after Trump announced Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, I told Macron that Trump is no longer a partner in any kind of the political process and can no longer be a partner in this process. What has happened and the way the U.S. acted specifically took them out of the role of being the broker for peace. They're not going to help anymore. They are out. Just echoing other comments that he said earlier on in the week. He also had a letter that was published today, a Christmas message from Mahmoud Abbas, and he spent it deriding the United States, saying, quote, that we will not accept the U.S. as the mediator in the peace process, nor are we going to accept any kind of plan from the U.S. side. Now, it's interesting, Macron said he's not going to get involved right now, but he is coming down earlier on in the year, in 2018. He's going to visit Palestine and Israel, according to him. Mahmoud Abbas is going to visit Brussels on January 22nd, and they are going to discuss the peace process and exchange their ideas there. Separate from the United States. Europe does seem to be a willing partner for the mediator role, but it's probably going to come maybe January or probably into February next year.
So looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, there are obviously a number of angles that are worth following here. What stands out the most to you based on what's happened, especially just within the last 2 days?
I would say, again, it's this increasing rhetoric from Europe. Point number one, we're ready to be the broker for peace here. The United States is out. We will take up that mantle, and how the Palestinians are jumping on board with this and being extremely vocal, considering where they get the bulk of their aid from, where they get the bulk of Mahmoud Abbas's money that's going in his pocket. It comes from the United States. He doesn't care, apparently. He thinks that Europe is going to pick up the tab. So that's one, considering that we know that Europe is going to take over that the peace brokering role that's outlined in numerous articles. One that people could look up is the Counterfeit Peacemaker. The Counterfeit Peacemaker, it was written back in 2001, but it just goes into this developing relationship between the Palestinians, Europeans, and also the Israelis. So that's point number one. I would also just want to really, the other thing that has really stood out to me is just how much Jerusalem itself is the focus now around the world. It's not about Israel in the UN. It was about Jerusalem. Jerusalem again was there. This time last year, Jerusalem was on the top chopping block again with Mr. Obama's resolution, and it's still there. It's not going to go away. Jerusalem is the focus. And even with Mr. Trump's decision, we just really need to analyze that because of what he didn't say. He didn't say that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of the Jews, all of Jerusalem. He said it is he said not West Jerusalem. He just said Jerusalem, but he left so much latitude there that I wouldn't be surprised if the United States government under Mr. Trump I wouldn't be surprised if he throws the Palestinians a bone at some point here in the future, showing that he is you know, getting rid of the elephant in the room at the beginning, stating that Jerusalem is the capital for Israel might open the door for him to say that Jerusalem is also the capital for the Palestinians. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. But it is, that's the world's focus mm-hmm. on Jerusalem now is the big picture point that people should take note of.
Well, keep your eyes on thetrumpet.com. We're covering this subject very closely. We do have, as Brent alluded to there, a lot of articles that demonstrate just how important this city is to end time events. And the focus of the world's attention right now really is extraordinary in light of those prophecies. We'll put some links to some articles in the show notes to the program today for you to follow up, but this is a crucial subject for you to look into. Certainly, you can look at our booklet, Jerusalem and Prophecy, to get the overview of what to expect in that city and just how much the sidelining of the United States' role in all of this fulfills those prophecies in a tremendous way. Well, we appreciate that, Brent. As nations around the world rebuke America for its stance on Jerusalem, President Donald Trump gave a speech this week and released a major document detailing his administration's new national security and foreign policy strategy. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, President Trump gave this speech on Monday. It's gotten quite a lot of publicity. It's not necessarily, at least in my opinion, a new strategy for him, but it's definitely one of the most clear explanations of what he's hoped to accomplish with his presidency. He really highlighted the fact that, I guess I can even read a little bit from the speech where he says, "We face regimes that threaten the United States and our allies. We face terrorist organizations, transnational criminal networks, and others who spread violence and evil around the globe. We also face rival powers, Russia and China, that seek to challenge America's influence, values, and wealth." And he went on to face all these challenges. He elucidated what he calls the four pillars of American security policy. He said, first, we must protect the American people, the homeland, and our great American way of life. And so this is really focusing mostly on border security. He talked about need to build a wall, strengthen homeland security, stop the flow of illegal immigrants into the country. Second, he wants to revitalize the American economy, bring more jobs, manufacturing jobs back from rivals like China to the United States. Third is a strategy of preserve peace through strength. This is mostly increases in the defense budget that he's proposing. And then the fourth one is to advance American influence worldwide. And that's basically just a summary of if we do these first three points, protect the homeland, revitalize the economy, and build up our military, America will be powerful enough that it will be more influential. And so it's kind of a reversal in a lot of ways of the Obama policy of more of this apologetic, reaching out to other nations, apologizing for America's role on the world, and just really trying to put America first and project power that way. Mm-hmm. And although I think one of the more interesting parts of the speech, and this is something that when you first hear it, it sounds like really patriotic American stuff, but then you there's something that when you hear it, you'll see it's not quite right, but. Where he's talking, he says, throughout American history, the American people have always been the true source of American greatness. Our people have promoted our culture and promoted our values. Americans have fought and sacrificed on the battlefields all over the world. We have liberated captive nations, transformed former enemies into the best of friends, and then lifted entire regions of the planet from poverty and prosperity. Because of our people, America has been among the greatest forces for peace and justice in the history of the world. The American people are generous, they are determined, you are brave, you are strong, and you are wise. And the list of accomplishments are all true accomplishments. Mm-hmm. These are things America has done on the world. And it definitely makes you feel good when you hear this type of language. I mean, I've always thought I was pretty brave and strong and wise. But...
Well, it is refreshing to hear a U.S. president who's willing to articulate that view after, like you said, the apologies and so on that we've heard from recent presidents. But you're taking exception with his basically crediting the American people for all of these virtues.
Right. Well, when I first thinking about that for a minute, I'm like, well, if you're so brave and you're so strong and we're so wise, why does America need to be made great again? How did it get toward the point where it's not great? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, let's compare this to, I guess, someone maybe you could consider the gold standard of presidents, Abraham Lincoln, when he was in the middle of the Civil War facing, I mean, President Trump talked about these threats from rival nations and drug cartels and terrorist groups and big problems. And so obviously Abraham Lincoln faced big problems, so big that Congress declared a day of prayer and fasting. And this is how Lincoln announced this day of prayer and fasting, where he says, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God, and we have forgotten his gracious hand, which preserves us in peace and multiplies us and enriches and strengthens us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own." Mm-hmm. Intoxicated by unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. And so you see that some of these things where Lincoln's talking about growing in peace and power and like no nation before sounds very similar to President Trump's speech.
He's crediting something very different.
But he's crediting the source of it to something that's very different. Mm-hmm. It's not the wisdom and the bravery and the strength of the American people. As a matter of fact, he attributes this Civil War to the fact that Americans think they're too wise and they're too brave and they're too strong, and they're taking credit for being the most powerful nation in the world when it's not. It's something that was given to them.
Yeah.
It's not something they took for themselves.
Well, it's a very good point. Looking at the overall strategy that he elucidated here, you said that it's not that different than what we've heard before from this president. And I just wonder if you're looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, and maybe even in light of what we're seeing, say, with the United Nations, like we were talking about with Brent, what lesson do you take from this? Or is there anything, just prophetically speaking, that you could look at as this may influence America's foreign policy or its standing in the world going forward?
Right. And I think Brent touched on some of these topics, is this kind of this American first policy is alienating some other nations. They don't necessarily like to hear that America's going to be first. And if you've got the strength to keep America as the superpower, maybe that's not such a bad thing. But like I said, if God's not blessing your effort going forward and you're picking a fight with many nations around the world, that can have some serious boomerang effects. And in fact, that is what the Bible talks about. Like in Isaiah 23, you talk about nations ganging up against America, or against the end time descendants of Israel, in trade war, and nations in Europe gathering together, 10 nations in Europe gathering together for a military war against America. And
just quickly, any resources that you would point people to for more information about what you're talking about there?
Well, and I think Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's book, Great Again, even in the very, like, the preface of the book, he really spends a lot of time talking about that there's a spiritual dimension to America's decline that most people don't see, and the crisis this nation is facing isn't because of a bad president. The cause is a lot deeper, and it's the same cause that President Lincoln explained, and Mr. Fleury explains that angle of being too self-reliant and forgetting God in here. But he also goes through a lot more of those specific prophecies that I mentioned that Abraham Lincoln wouldn't have been able to explain about what our 10 nations in Europe prophesied to do to America and what our nations around the world prophesied to do trade-wise to America because of self-reliance and being too proud to pray and taking credit for America's greatness when it's was something that was a gift.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've been talking a lot about the trouble that Germany is having forming a new government. Well, Austria isn't having any trouble. This past Monday, it swore in its new governing coalition, which will have the 31-year-old Sebastian Kurz at the helm as chancellor. This gives some fascinating insight into the state of European politics at this moment in history. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, this is quite a moment for Austria, because mostly because of Kurz's coalition partners. So he will be ruling with the help of the Freedom Party of Austria, the FPO. And this is quite a far-right party. It's one that's usually considered extreme, one that's usually considered kind of beyond the pale. It was founded by Anton Reintheller. He was a former SS officer in the Nazi period. So, you know, interesting roots, to put it mildly. Well, their leader was arrested in 1989 for taking part in the Hitler Youth style torchlight neo-Nazi rally. He's been photographed posing with guns alongside neo-Nazis. They've been, you know, all kinds of these incidents. People, for example, another party leader posted a picture of SS troops on Facebook with the caption, "Our grandfathers were not criminals." So they're not, you know, they're not as a public platform saying we need to bring back Nazism, but they certainly have some more extreme beliefs. And you look at what some of their people have been found doing in the past, and they're reasonably comfortable cozying up to Nazism, if we put it that way.
So this is kind of what the concern was when Kurz was his party received the most votes, that there was a certain amount of trepidation elsewhere in Europe that Austria was taking this course. And in some ways, this is kind of the fulfillment of what those concerns were.
Exactly. And he did talk about going in coalition with the FPO. You know, we made the contrast at the time with Germany, where Angela Merkel said, no, we would never, ever, ever do a coalition deal with the far right or the extreme right. He was very open that he would consider it and he would negotiate and go with whoever gave him the best deal. Now, this isn't the first time that his party has partnered and gotten the support of the Freedom Party of Austria. But I think that's one of the things that makes this example so informative. So back in 2000, the same party came to power in Austria with the same, you know, with the support of the far right. And the response from the rest of the world back then was dramatically different. Mm-hmm. You had a diplomatic boycott from the whole EU and from Israel and from the United States. Israel and the United States, they even withdrew their ambassadors until, you know, one particularly extreme member of the FPO had resigned from the government. So it was a big outcry back then, big news, and everybody was very concerned about this. This time, this is kind of the least of Europe's worries, and they're quite happy to, you know, they've said, well, it's a pro-European government. At least they're not trying to get Austria out of the European Union as one of their stated goals. Therefore, we're going to welcome them in. We'll work with them. We're glad to have them. And
how times have changed.
It's going to be big business as usual.
Yeah. It's quite a big change in a short amount of time.
Exactly.
So just looking at this prophetically, obviously, we've talked about just the shift to the right being a very significant trend within Europe. And in some ways, this in Austria, right next to Germany there, this is kind of the point of the spear of this trend, wouldn't you say?
To a certain extent. I think you've also got part of the reason why Europe is so keen to welcome in the FPO is they at least see Kurz as less extreme as some of his neighbors further east, at least when it comes to opposing Brussels on immigration and that kind of thing. So, yeah, to a certain extent. I think the other thing that's important to mention just before we move on is that that the FPO also, they control some really significant ministries in this new administration. They're basically over the police, they're over the army, they're over intelligence. So they have got a huge amount of power. I think even perhaps probably more power over those kind of areas than they had in the last coalition. So, yeah, it's Austria is just part of a trend that's sweeping across the whole continent. And I think some EU leaders kind of see it almost as the lesser of two evils, that if they don't work with the far right, well, could you see almost like a far right takeover? So I think that's part of the reason why they're opening them in with open arms. But yeah, you look at the trend across Europe, you look at Germany. This week, Germany set a new record for the longest time they've ever been without a government. And they're still going. It was just over a week ago where the leader of the Social Democratic Party said that they don't expect to finish negotiations until Easter. And even to get there, there's still a lot of hurdles to go through. So you're looking at Germany being without a government until April, potentially, perhaps even longer. So you can really see that politics across the continent are going through major, major upheaval.
To get more context here, where would you send people if somebody was interested?
Well, a couple of places. We have, as usual, we'll plug our trends article section at the top right of the website, and that will really take you through a strongman of Germany to lead Europe. There's an article there that will just take you step by step through all of the prophecies of what's coming to Europe, because the Bible is very specific about where this upheaval in Europe is leading, where these events are taking us. It is leading to a strong leader in Europe that's written in talked about in scriptures like Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 11. And that will take you step by step and prove that. And then we also have our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent by Mr. Gerald Flurry, that will just go into even more depth on those prophecies and just show so clearly how what is happening in Europe is just coming right out of Bible prophecy.
Terrific. Thanks for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Over now to Asia, where North Korea is testing ICBMs and nuclear weapons. China is getting more and more aggressive in the region. Well, in the waters around South Korea, there was a dramatic incident this week that shows just how tense the situation over there is. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the South Korean Coast Guard said on Wednesday that they had fired a volley of warning shots at a group of Chinese fishing vessels that were swarming around one of their patrol ships there in South Korean waters. And the South Koreans actually fired hundreds of shots during this conflict. These Chinese boats were illegally fishing in South Korean waters. There were 44 Chinese boats. And when a Korean patrol ship came to tell them to vacate that area, they started to swarm this Korean patrol ship. And so the South Koreans were broadcasting warning messages for the Chinese to steer clear, but they just kept on swarming the South Korean vessel. So finally, the South Koreans began firing these warning shots. And it was only after they had fired 249 shots that the Chinese boats finally started to retreat.
China is basically using these fishing fleets as an extension of its navy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This fits a pattern of China using its fishing boats as an unofficial extension of its military. China uses what some analysts call maritime militias to boost Beijing's sovereignty claims in the South China Sea and in other waters that Beijing or other waters that belong to China's neighbors. And Andrew Erickson is a professor of strategy at the U.S. Naval War College, and he's been following this Chinese trend very carefully over the years, and he says that China's fishermen are fighting a covert war in the South China Sea and in other waters near China. And so we see this happening in the East China Sea. We see it in the Yellow Sea, which is where this clash with South Korea happened this week. And Dr. Erickson has documented other incidents in which Chinese fishermen have clashed with Indonesian officials, Malaysians, Vietnamese, and others. And it's all just a way for China to push ahead with its long-running battle to expand China's fishing grounds and also to expand China's maritime dominance all around its periphery. And all the while, Beijing has plausible deniability. You know, the government can say, I'm sorry, these are just rogue fishermen misbehaving. But it's very clear that they're actually following government orders. And That's clear because these fishing boats are often accompanied by Chinese Coast Guard vessels. It's also clear because the Chinese fishermen are trained to use small arms, and they often have weapons that would be highly illegal for an ordinary Chinese civilian to have.
Yeah. So the fishermen from China, they've got well-equipped fishermen. This is kind of an interesting, and the South Koreans know it. They're responding to this as the threat that it is. Looking at this from the standpoint of, say, China's overall strategy and prophetic context, we were talking with Andrew on Wednesday about just its seizing sea gates around the world, and this kind of aggression on the part of China in these waters around South Korea. It really does show just how strategic its thinking is with regard to maritime interests.
Yeah, that's right. To really understand the significance of what's happening with China's maritime militias, you really have to understand the prophecies of the Bible that you spoke about with Andrew on the Wednesday show. In Deuteronomy 28, God delivers a very sobering warning to the descendants of Israel, which are largely modern-day America today, partly at least. And this warning said that if the people disobeyed God, he would give the strategic gates of the world over to their enemies. And these enemies would end up using these sea gates to besiege and eventually defeat the descendants of Israel. The passage there in Deuteronomy 28:52 says, "And he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted, throughout all your land, and he shall besiege you in all your gates throughout all your land, which the Lord your God has given you." And so all of this Chinese activity beside the South Korean coast and elsewhere, it's all really to the detriment of America's control of these shipping lanes, of vital sea gates and trade routes. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has written a very powerful article showing that China's push against the status quo in these areas is moving toward the fulfillment of this prophecy in Deuteronomy. His article is called "China is Steering the World Toward War." And we'll have a link to that in the show notes for this episode.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the high cost the Obama administration paid in order to secure the Iran nuclear deal, how Iran is poised to gain political control in Iraq, a shift toward religion in Poland, and more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Terrible revelations emerged this week of the high price the Obama administration paid in order to secure its nuclear deal with Iran, allowing some terrible activity by one of Iran's most powerful terror proxies, Hezbollah. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Well, for a number of years, the U.S. government has known that Hezbollah has been engaged in helping drug cartels in order to raise money to send back to finance terrorism in the Middle East. I remember actually writing a piece on that some 10 years ago. But now this week, we've got new revelations that the Obama administration actually called off the investigation into these illegal money-raising activities as part of the negotiations over the Iran deal. It was a political piece published by Josh Meyer late last week where he just really lays out, it's really long, a lot of pages of details about, well, first of all, the logistics of how Hezbollah is raising like around $1 billion in like illegal car sales and money laundering and drug trafficking that it's using to send back to the Middle East to finance terrorism. The U.S. government was investigating it under the Bush administration. They started doing a lot of deep investigation into it. But since Hezbollah is an arm of Iran, Iran didn't like these investigations into Hezbollah's drug trafficking links. And so they had asked President Obama to call off the investigations as part of this nuclear deal. He worked with them, and he agreed to do this. And this is something actually, there's an article on our website right now from Mr. Stephen Flurry, and there's also his Trumpet Daily program. Both him and Richard discussed this on the Trumpet Daily program on Monday that just goes into a lot of these details. But I'd really encourage any of our website readers or listeners to go back and take a either listen or read one of those pieces, because this really is a really big story exposing, well, one, not just the corruption of American politics, but two, just the fact that these drug cartels, some people say they're the biggest domestic security threat to America because they're so close to their border and they're so powerful. And now they're teaming up with terrorists who have a lot of have state sponsored terrorists who could get nuclear weapons soon. And the U.S. government's turning a blind eye to that.
Yeah, quite an alarming story. The title of that article by Stephen Fleury, Why Obama Blocked the Hezbollah Probe. Check that out on thetrumpet.com. And you can also, it's just amazing to think about this in light of the truth that is exposed in America Under Attack, the booklet by Gerald Fleury, and Great Again, also by Gerald Fleury, that just show the political, or the, sorry, the spiritual dimension behind the problems facing the United States. And when you see these kinds of policies being enacted that are so blatantly against American interests, you can't help but think about just what is really going on here on the spiritual level. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. We're going to move on now. The problems with America's foreign policy in the Middle East and Iran in particular are clear all the time. We're going to go now to a story we've been watching closely in the Middle East. Iraq has been largely rid of the Islamic State, but that victory came in large part because of Iran. And now those forces that are loyal to Iran, that helped boot the Islamic State and dismantle it, they want to translate their battlefield gains into greater political power. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
We've talked a lot about the fight against the Islamic State and how you said it was backed and supported by forces in Iraq that are loyal, not necessarily to the Iraqi government, but more loyal to the Iranians. And they took a lot of their orders from the Iranians. Yes, they did fight against the Islamic State. But we said during that time, since 2014, when they were really participated in this fight, that we were looking at this as a way of Iran gaining control and gaining power over Iraq. Because what are those fighters going to do once the Islamic State is removed? And the largest group of these, largest conglomeration of these militias that answer mainly to Iran is known as the Popular Mobilization Forces, or units. There are estimates that they have somewhere between 120,000 to 140,000 members. That's a lot of ground forces, a lot of fighters. But now, since the Islamic State has dissolved, well, gradually, of course, there's still small pockets of it, but largely in Iraq, the Islamic State is gone. The question remains, what happens to these 140,000 soldiers? And initially, it looks like the Iraqi government, under the Prime Minister Abadi, he's trying to absorb these fighters into the army itself to ensure that, and then break them up from their previous militia status so that they would he could then control their power as best he could in the future. But what we're seeing is, yes, these militias are starting to break up, and some of them are being absorbed into the army, but others are now saying that they want to form a political group instead in order for them to participate or continue to be viable, basically, after the Islamic State is gone, the rationale for their existence is gone, then they're going to direct themselves into the political arena. And to do that, according to Iraqi law, you can't be active militarily. And so some of these groups, including the largest that belongs to the PMF, the Sada group and the Bada group, they are handing over their weapons even and saying, we are now a political organization.
Yeah, they're being quite open about it, aren't they? This is in advance of parliamentary elections that are scheduled for this coming spring. And they're basically saying, OK, since we can't legally do the military service and political service at the same time, we're turning over our weapons, going into politics. Now it's time to secure those things that would be in Iran's interests within Iraq in the political sphere.
Right, right. That's so true. I mean, it's two ways of looking at this. They are going to their men. A lot of their men are actually joining the military. But then you have to ask, where do their loyalties lie? If push comes to shove, are they going to be governed by the state institution, or are they going to stay in the military and then still answer to their, in many cases, their Iranian leaders as well? But it's also dangerous because now you're going to have not just Iranian operatives inside the military, but also inside the political institution as well. Now, this has always been the case. Some of these groups, before they even formed militias, they were political organizations. But the clout that they have now inside Iraq is very worrying. And a lot of Iraqi politicians, especially the Sunnis and the Kurds, they're worried that they're going to be dominated not just by Shiites now in the parliament, but Shiites that answer to Iran.
And this is something that the United States came out. We talked before about how once the Islamic State was defeated, you know, Rex Tillerson came out and said, we've got to disband these militias. Other foreign leaders have said the same thing. And essentially, this is in defiance of all of that. I mean, disbanding the militias is one thing, but basically moving from that sphere to the political sphere as brazenly as they are, this is something that you'd have to say, even in France and other European capitals, they're looking at this and saying, wow, this isn't something that we can just stand by and allow to happen.
Yeah, well, they definitely didn't want this to they definitely wanted the militias to lose their power. But again, with these elections coming up, the Europeans did. But with these elections coming up in May, it really does seem that they are going to hold the majority of the power inside the parliament. The popular mobilization units look like they're going to form one list, meaning they're going to be part of one party. And then they are, it looks like Maliki, who is the pro-Iranian leader that was before Abadi, he's the vice president right now. He said that his list is going to actually ally with the PMF. So you're going to have the pro-Iranian leader, the pro-Iranian Iraqi leader that's the vice president right now, his whole group is going to ally with the PMF in the elections, which means we will have a puppet state.
Yeah.
A puppet state.
Right.
With Iraq.
Well, you put it in the context of what Gerald Fleury was said, 2003 and before, about how we could expect Iraq to end up being under the thumb, under the control of Iran. And this is very specific fulfillment of exactly what we've been expecting.
Yeah, it is. It takes the territorial gains that we saw took place over the past 2 years of Iran in Iraq through the actual militias to now make it a political move, which makes it all but a foregone conclusion that Iran is going to govern Iraq. Something, again, that we've been saying. If you want to go back to one of those articles, Is Iraq About to Fall to Iran, back from 2003, and even that article quoted what we wrote back in the early 90s, that this was eventually going to happen. Mm-hmm. Iran was going to control Iraq, and we are seeing the final stages of this. It's accomplished. Come these elections in May, it looks like it's going to be fully accomplished.
It was all based on prophecies in Daniel 11 and Psalm 83, and you can get our booklet, The King of the South, in order to look into those prophecies more deeply. And that article as well is, will Iran, what was it? Is Iraq going to fall to Iran? Yep. You can find that under the show notes for the program today, but definitely worth looking into. And this is just one of those very dramatic fulfillments of a specific prophecy that led to a specific forecast. It's unfolding exactly the way that we expected it to. It really does show just how accurate looking at the news and analyzing it from a standpoint of biblical prophecy can be. Well, we appreciate that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. One biblical prophecy we've drawn attention to for decades, and that Herbert W. Armstrong did before us very strongly, is how Sunday worship would end up being enforced within Europe. Now, quite a dramatic headline emerged this week out of Poland that brought this prophecy right back into the spotlight. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, Poland is very much in the news right now and its role in Europe. So just over the last week, the European Commission has started procedures to place sanctions on Poland. This is the first time the EU has ever begun down this road in its history, because they say that it violates the EU's rules on the rule of law, which is an absolute joke. If the EU had reasonable rules on the rule of law, they would have violated them many, many times themselves. And then even when we spoke about the vote at the UN, it was Eastern Europe, a lot of these Eastern European countries, that broke with the likes of France and Germany to abstain on the vote there. So you're having this growing divide now in Europe, and it looks like you're even heading towards perhaps this showdown between Brussels and Poland and many of these other Eastern states. And one of the big parts of that is the role of religion. So over the last week or so, for example, the Polish prime minister said, "We want to change Europe. My dream is to make it Christian again." So many of these leaders are openly talking about having a different vision for the European Union, and one that's quite different to the people that are currently in control in Brussels. And another sign of this is Poland's decision to change or to roll back its laws on Sunday. Now, Sunday trading laws are very common within Europe. Even within the UK, we have very frustrating laws about when big shops can and can't open on Sunday. And so, but I think what's unique about what Poland is doing is that they're moving in the opposite direction to the way Europe has traditionally been moving. They've generally been liberalizing these Sunday laws, allowing more Sunday shopping, this kind of thing. Whereas they voted on November 24 to start phasing out Sunday shopping. So it's going to start in 2018 with most shops being closed 2 Sundays each month, then only 1 Sunday, then by 2020 only 7 Sundays in the year. And so you're seeing a completely different direction of travel to what we've seen for most of Poland's history, and or at least recent history, all of Europe's recent history. We're seeing a revival of the role religion is playing in that very specific way there. And then you put that together with those quotes from those in Poland, from the Polish prime minister there, and you see this is part of a different vision for all of Europe. And now this is a trend that we've been really expecting for in Europe. It's one that we've often had a lot of prophecy to support, but not necessarily a huge amount of evidence to support. But in the last few weeks, months, years, there's been growing evidence now of religion playing a much more important role in Europe. This is one of the latest incidents of that. We have an article from our November 2017 Trumpet print edition called "A Religious Revival in Europe." And that takes you through all of that longstanding prophecy that we've been talking about for years and years, and that you can now see more and more world events matching up with. So you can read more about that in that article, "A Religious Revival in Europe," and we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Richard. We're going to finish with one last story. This from Asia. The United Nations is concerned about what it's calling a devolution of democracy in Cambodia, going so far as to say that Cambodia's membership status in the UN should come under review. To learn what the concern is and why it's important to us, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, for Cambodia, 2017 was really a year of breaking with the U.S. and breaking with democracy. On a show earlier this year, we talked about Cambodia kicking a U.S. Navy unit out of the country. And now this month, the government has dissolved the only relevant opposition party, which was the Cambodia National Rescue Party, or the CNRP. The CNRP had 55 seats in Cambodia's 123-seat National Assembly. So it was a really powerful force, but now just overnight, that party is no more. And it's being called the terminal blow to democracy in Cambodia. And this was all orchestrated by Prime Minister Hun Sen. He was once a commander in Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge, and now he's been ruling Cambodia for about 32 years, and it's just been very common for him to use courts and security forces to crush his opponents. And this also comes as the government has been cracking down on the press to a really alarming degree, and basically just taking a very populist path that puts Cambodia totally at odds with the U.S. and the U.N. And America has responded to this with a sanctions package on Cambodia. And so it's really just brought U.S.-Cambodian relations to a historic low.
And how does this stand to unfold here? Who stands to benefit from this?
Well, the tension between Cambodia and the U.S. is happening as Cambodia moves deeper into the Chinese camp. So it's difficult to say whether China is just the beneficiary of this or whether China is actually causing it. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, Cambodia has taken out almost $3 billion in loans from China for all kinds of development projects. Then last October, China forgave almost $90 million of Cambodia's debts. So that really won Beijing quite a lot of favor and goodwill in Phnom Penh there. And the same shift is underway in military matters. Last year, Cambodia conducted its first ever joint naval drills with China. And Cambodia welcomed military training and a bunch of weapons from China as well. And in January of this year, Cambodia canceled a major annual joint military exercise with the United States. So it's clear that Cambodia is shifting away from its historic alignment with the U.S. and toward a much closer alignment with China. And this is a trend that we're seeing happen not just in Cambodia, but in several of the smaller Asian nations, including Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, and others.
If somebody wants more information on this, the prophetic significance of this, where would you send them?
Well, the Bible says that in the end time, an era will begin called the times of the Gentiles. Jesus Christ used this phrase in Luke 21:24, and the context shows that these times will occur after a shift in global power takes place, pushing power away from America and toward two main power blocks, one of them led by Germany, a European bloc, and the other one an Asian bloc led by Russia and China. And so for this prophesied time to occur, there has to be a shift of power to China. So these shifts by Cambodia that we're seeing take place and other smaller Asian nations, they're just laying the groundwork for this biblically prophesied times of the Gentiles to begin. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written a very powerful article from our July 2014 print edition. It's called What Are the Times of the Gentiles? And it explains this passage in Luke and many other Bible passages and just shows that these things are being fulfilled in the world today.
All right. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we talked about on the program today. We'll try to put as many links in the show notes as we can so that you can get as much context as possible to what we talked about. Let us know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Herbert Spencer. The ultimate result of shielding men from the effects of folly is to fill the world with fools. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.